us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Tuesday. That means Tuesdays with my co-host Sandy Williams. And we're having a lively discussion and serious discussion about, you know, our nation, where our nation is at this point in its history, and why it's so important that we talk about the things that have brought us to the precipice of where we are, where we can't see one another as Americans, and things are not getting any better. At some point in time, this conversation has to be had. It has to be had in the halls of justice. It has to be had in Congress. It has to be had in the churches. It has to be had on the street. Because anybody who doesn't realize that our nation is at a crossroads, I'm sorry for you. And if you think as we enter into another, election season, you know, and people see different reasons for why they vote for somebody else, at stake really is a time where if we don't get this thing worked out, there's some long-term damage that's going to be done to our nation, and I don't know if it can be turned around. Sandy?
Well, I think in thinking about, you know, how we've gotten to where we are and then bringing politics into it, in some respects, I think that the William and Hillary Clinton strategy of the multicolored quilt and the coalition, essentially it was an effort to build a coalition of tribes, okay? But to recognize the tribal difference and then to appeal to them and to build a national movement that was the coalition of all these tribes has been part of the problem, actually, because it continued, it put greater emphasis in everyone's mind on these differences between us, and then the Democratic Party, to some extent, became the place where people were supposed to reside who were amongst this multicolored quilt. And what we should be focusing on is the shared problems of people, regardless of what tribe they belong to. And to me, the silver lining of the problem we have in this economy and in the society right now, which is the plight of the middle class, the median family, the fact that the median family has to struggle today, that the standard of living of the middle class has actually depreciated from what the standard of living was in the past for the middle class because of the benefits which they've lost and the private benefit sources that they've lost, which they now have to fund out of their incomes, okay? And this is a shared problem that's shared by people of all different tribal backgrounds. And if we start appealing to and solving the major problem in this country, which is the structure of our economy and the plight of the middle class, we might actually bring ourselves together.
You know, 844-967-2789 is the number. And, you know, clearly, our listening audience is that. It is the middle class, and for the most part. And so whether you're a middle-class Democrat or a middle-class Republican, you face the same thing. And yet now, the fact that either you're a Democrat or a Republican supersedes, you know, the issues that we have in common.
Well, politically, we've tried to focus people's attention on, I think, things that are not their pocketbook, but there are other issues. And you know, it is, in fact, it's your pocketbook, stupid. It's the economy, stupid. It's your pocketbook, stupid. And if we were focusing on what's happening to people's pocketbook and to their personal families, financial issues that they face, we would recognize that it's daycare availability for all at a low cost. It's education available through college at an affordable cost. It's
buying a home.
It's healthcare available for all. Okay, it's the things that could ease the budgetary problems of the middle class and put them back in the situation they were in 1970 when they had a middle class income and could then afford to buy a home. The reason they can't afford to buy a home today, yes, homes are expensive. Quite frankly, they've always been expensive, relatively speaking. Homes are expensive, but the reason they can't buy a home is because health care is a very expensive part of their budget now, which never was part of their budget. Daycare is an expensive part of their budget now, which wasn't a part of their budget when they were single breadwinner middle-class families. And secondary and post-secondary education is terribly expensive now, and many of the families who would be looking to buy a home have student debt hanging over their head. They have to pay off and can't afford to buy a home for those reasons. So if you take those problems out of the mix, we can move the middle class into a much more vibrant situation, and we can give hope to all of the members of our society of various sorts. But we're going to have a sense of community in order to decide we need to solve those problems, and that we've got to get away from saying everybody needs to solve all those problems for themselves in this ruggedly individualistic society, because quite frankly, the tools aren't there to solve those problems yourself.
All right, David. Good morning to you. David from Mequon. Go ahead, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. Really quickly, Sandy, I just want you to realize, listen, I respect what you're saying as far as, you know, the ideology of what you want to see happen. But I would point out the reality is this. If you look at California, which is the most populous state, they have implemented pretty much everything that you just slated as far as, you know, health care for everybody in the state of California. They have basically, they're now expanding. Now, keep in mind, the governor of California just expanded again health care to an additional 700,000 illegal immigrants that are in the state of California. And they have a $68 billion budget hole. And you see what's happening with the businesses and leaving in California. California is having a massive exodus of people because it is not affordable there. They have passed regulations. They just passed a regulation on January 1st. If you look at, they just increased their minimum wage again. And I sent an article to Earl a few days ago. The Pizza Hut chains laid off every single delivery driver. It was 1,900 drivers.
Okay, so they,
due to the minimum wage.
So, and
there's going to be 50,000 additional people that are going to lose their jobs.
I know, so Dave. So what is the solution?
Well, wait a minute, though. Let's just parse this out a little bit, because you can take California, but you can also take Germany or Sweden or any number of other places in the world that have addressed all these problems and have a different situation. California's problems, to some extent, the healthcare problem in this country is because of the way we have structured healthcare in this country and the expense of healthcare in this country, which is off the charts as compared to the expense of healthcare in every other country. With respect to the laying off of a bunch of drivers, if those drivers were working 35 hours a week at something under $15 an hour in California, they were probably also eligible for food stamps.
Benefits. No
and
question.
Benefits, okay? So they weren't earning a working wage. And should we allow business models to exist who pay people less than a working, less than a livable wage, far less than a livable wage, should that be a business model that is supported? I mean, Pizza Hut prices can go up, all right? And they might have to go up if they pay their workers a living wage. But should we really countenance businesses that have a business model that doesn't pay a living wage? People would look at Walmart, for instance, and point out the extent to which they have workers at Walmart, all of whom are eligible for benefits because of the fact that they don't earn a working wage.
Well, again.
So they aren't really. Is that really employment? What is that? I think, to me, That's almost a subsidy to the business, all right? They're being the workers are being subsidized by benefits so they can work for less than a living wage and benefit who? Pizza Hut?
You're you're missing the bigger picture.
What's the bigger picture, David?
The bigger picture is that California already had the minimum wage of $15 an hour. Actually, it was higher than that. They just increased it again to like about $21.
Yeah, but $21. But $21 an hour. Just do the math.
In California.
In California, do the math.
Poverty.
And it doesn't make it. Okay. I mean, I just think that, first of all, economists have studied increases in minimum wage, and they've demonstrated that increases in minimum wage don't end up on a macro basis costing a lot of jobs, okay? And what's happened in America is that we have an increasing number of businesses whose business model has become premised on, one, hourly workers, and two, no benefits paid to the workers. And that is the very problem I've described that is faced by median family America. The median family in Wisconsin earns $64,000-$65,000 a year with two breadwinners. That means that if you split that in half, which is undoubtedly not the norm in every case, you've got $32,000 a year of income for each breadwinner. Now, $32,000 a year is subsistence.
That's a state tax rate on state income of almost 14% on the highest rate. So what's happening is now businesses have decided they're leaving, and what's happening is the middle class is getting hurt more because as more businesses decide to leave, keep in mind, there's no job opportunity.
Hey, David, I hear you, and so there's also a broader swath of people in poverty. We talk about the middle class, but if you know, $21 an hour in California certainly is not enough money to live.
I think the better question, Dave, is what is the solution? Because I think you would agree that the median family in America is faces an uphill fight right now, and they don't face the same situation as the median family faced in 1975. So then the question is not what's going wrong in California, but what's the right course of action?
844-967-2789. You can join the conversation. Join us at 844-967-2789 and text us at that same number. It's Tuesday. That means Tuesdays with my co-host Sandy Williams. And just that conversation that was just had with David, you know, about why, you know, businesses can't afford to do the kinds of things that are necessary to assist our fellow countrymen to be able to live you know, in this nation comfortably. America is not what she ought to be and could be if we've got so many people struggling in her. And so you can't say, well, it's the greatest nation on earth for a segment of people when there's so many people, Sandy, who don't see that, and who do what is asked of them. We're talking about people that are working, Sandy. These people work.
Yeah.
Right? And then people say, well, they should be able to get a better job. Well, you know, that's just not the case anymore. The better jobs and aren't being created that are going to pay people.
Well, you know, there are a bunch of vacant jobs, but they require training. Okay?
Right.
Or that better jobs are located where the people aren't located. I think there's a significant train, you know, for instance, the trades. I think there's clearly a shortage of workers for many of the trades. But the trades require a period of training. Most of the people who are working now have an urgency about the work. You know, they're trying to make ends meet. But I see the peril in our society is really driven by the economic frustration, by the stress of living paycheck to paycheck that so many people have. There's a stress in the rural environment. Those who live in smaller towns around the country who have lost their jobs and are faced with the need to either uproot and move from their small community or face much lesser employment as their options. So the rural plight is different than the urban plight. The urban plight involves the need to absolutely have a job. There's no opportunity for subsistence. And furthermore, there might well be a training differential between the capacities you have and the requirements of the job that might be available, as well as transportation issues and other things that are causing frictional problems. But, you know, we continue to have in Milwaukee, in the African-American community, we continue to have employment issues. We continue to have median family incomes that I'm sure are materially less than the median family income of the state, so that the problems that are being experienced there are greater. But every young person graduating from high school today faces a future which seems much more fraught with difficulty than the futures that were faced by, for instance, the baby boom generation. And it's those difficulties and those frustrations which essentially put at peril our society.
You know, Sandy, the pain is the same whether it's in rural America or whether it's in urban America. The pain of not knowing what's going to happen next. The pain of not knowing whether you can pay your rent. The pain of not knowing whether or not there's going to be food on the table. The pain of whether or not you can afford to pay a heating bill when the winter rolls around and you're making not even 15 bucks an hour, because that's not what the minimum wage is in Milwaukee or Wisconsin. It's still $7.50. Let's go to Tom from L.A. Good morning to you, Tom. You say what?
Good morning, Earl. I hope you let me say everything I got here. One, I am just dumbfounded. I'm going to push back on Sandy a little bit, first off. First, we the people ultimately together are the government, and we must never forget that. Sandy, you were talking about different factions and things like that. I don't see what it hurts for white Anglo-Saxon Protestant men, straight men, to actually be kind to other groups of people. I know you didn't grow up in the skin of a gay person or a black person, but what you're saying there about, you know, if we all just focus on the four different indices, which I agree with, that's one thing. But Billings, Hillary Clinton, if anything, tried to do what they could to actually include the whole patchwork of people. And it doesn't just include the white, Anglo, straight man. And then also on top of that, Dave, I don't know what the hell you're talking about either. Because California is the fifth largest economy in the world. All these little statistics that he's coming up with are absolutely not true about California. So I wish he would actually cite his sources. And also, California is probably the only state that could actually go it on its own and doesn't need any of the other states to do it. In fact, we probably would do better because we actually give more money to the taker states, the red states. I know Wisconsin's not one of them, but the red states actually take more money from California than we actually get back. So the problem that happened, if you want to know the truth, is money and politics. It was Citizens United. It was the fact that the Democrats had to glum on to some rich billionaire that was going to help them win campaigns. So they picked the banking industry. They picked other industries to actually be able to finance their campaigns. The Republicans picked oil and gas and things like this, which they always had the backing of. So now all of a sudden you got both parties mooching on or going on to some billionaire that's going to basically pay for their expenditures for their campaigns, and now they're all owned.
Well, I totally agree with you that the money in politics is one of the fundamental things that needs to happen in order to open the door for solutions to actual problems we face. I'm scratching my head about the white Anglo-Saxon male thing. I don't understand what I said that could have been construed that way. But, I certainly agree that money in politics is the most fundamental problem we've got that is addressable. And could change, could be a sea change in how we begin to address the problems that are faced by middle-class families in America.
Tom, thank you very much for the call. 844-967-2789. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Tuesday. That means Sandy Williams is on board. Can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Tuesday. That means Tuesday is my co-host Sandy. And so, Sandy, we've been talking about what issues are and what some of the major stumbling blocks are as we look at where our nation has come from, where it is today, where it is headed, and we've got a major election coming up. Let's do this. Let's take Tom from West Dallas first. Hey, good morning to you, Tom. How you doing? Thank you very much for the call.
Good morning. Good morning, gentlemen. I'm doing fine. I hope you are too. Please stay out of this weather and get home early. A lot of this issue, though, is when do businesses make enough money? Like, why does it seem like no one has a problem with Walmart people receiving government benefits, food stamps, all that stuff, when they work for the richest people on the planet? Same with Bezos and Amazon. They work those people to death. They could easily hire more people, pay them more, and it wouldn't hurt Bezos one bit. We got to see that it's also the ultra wealthy and the wealthy need to also take a little bit of a cut so the others can make more money. And if they could make more money, they could buy more products. Or am I off base on this whole thing?
No, I don't think you're off base in terms of the fact that if the middle class of this country earned more money, the manufacturers and businesses in this country would be better off. And furthermore, I think that one of the problems in the architecture of our economy is we have allowed far too many companies to build a business model which is premised on paying their human capital, as the term is used, too little. Okay, they've by paying them less than a living wage, we've begun to forge a society in which two breadwinners aren't just optional but are required for a family. And you know, in the 1950s and 60s, that was the exception, not the rule. Now it's the rule, not the exception, because it's mandatory in order to achieve an income that gets you to the point where you can sustain a living. And unfortunately, in the United States, with a median income with two breadwinners of about $76,000 a year, and in the state of Wisconsin with a median income with two breadwinners of about $65,000 a year, we end up with families living paycheck to paycheck and experiencing a great deal of financial stress. So clearly, one of the problems in our economy is that people are being asked to work full-time for less than a livable wage, which means that business models are premised on paying their human capital too little.
So, Sandy, so we know that. Who's going to turn that around? It's almost like, you know, that ship is too big to turn around. You know, it's in shallow water, and it
well, shortages of workers help to increase income, and there has been a shortage of workers for a while, which managed to start getting wage rates going up faster than inflation. But you know, quite frankly, it's going to probably require political action in order to establish standards for instance, requiring that benefits be paid by employers, or by removing the obligation of businesses to pay benefits and taking on, for instance, Medicare for All as a government obligation. And in most countries, businesses aren't obligated to pay benefits because they're provided by the state, okay? And so in many respects, I would think that the businesses of this country would begin to get unified about shifting these obligations with respect to benefits in the direction of the community, meaning the state. And the community view in other countries has driven the state, which is the reflection of the community, into providing these kinds of important benefits, healthcare, education, child daycare.
And in those countries, Sandy, they don't look at that as welfare. They don't look at that in the condescending
no, because
view. But in our nation, they look at that, you know, as
a handout,
right?
Yeah, you know, this notion of an entitlement, the handout. But the other countries have a community view, which is that the community will be better off if everyone in the community is well educated, if everyone in the community has health care so they're healthy, if everyone in the community has child daycare so their children come to school prepared with preschool education and child daycare. And the child daycare is a reflection of the fact that most countries have recognized that two breadwinners is part of the process for the economy, and so therefore child daycare is necessary.
So there are ebbs and flows in economies, you know, and we're in this area or time frame, Sandy, where the corporations have benefited, they have gotten away without paying benefits and all those things for a long time. What's going to force them again? They've gotten comfortable, these record profits. They're not going to all of a sudden get religion, you know, and decide that, hey, we're going to cut into our profits, because that's what's going to have to happen. They're going to have to cut into their profits in order to offer these benefits that we're talking about.
Well, like I said, it probably is going to require political action for people to address the fact that business models should be premised on paying living wages to workers who work full time. And, you know, if business models are premised on paying less than a living wage to full time workers, then the business model is faulty. And so that probably requires political action in order to make sure that occurs. You know, it used to be that broad scale unionization sort of took care of that issue. But since we now have unionization is the exception and not the rule, we end up with only the government or the marketplace to dictate.
You know, Sandy, it was political action that changed it from what it was. When companies were allowed to, you know, move overseas, they didn't do that on their own volition.
Well, no, I mean, companies were allowed. Companies moved overseas. I'm not sure that the government could have kept them from moving overseas. But when it opened up that world trade was such that with the tariffs were reduced to the point where it was okay to move overseas. But the first thing that happened was the movement to so-called right to work states,
right to work being a euphemism. Southern states.
Yes. So, you know, what really happened was that at some point, and it was really beginning in the early 1970s, late 1960s, companies began to very aggressively try to reduce their payments to human capital, right? They began to try to reduce their cost of operations by reducing wages and finding ways to reduce them. And the first way was to move to so-called right-to-work states, which was a euphemism for non-union states, and then to move to Nogales and places like that in Mexico that were allowing them to access even cheaper foreign labor, and then abroad to China and Vietnam and all sorts of places where they could access cheaper labor. But some of that movement was also so they could access those foreign markets.
So, Sandy, now, you know, hindsight being 2020, there's data that will corroborate that what transpired during those times have not been beneficial to the middle class. It has certainly been detrimental and caused what we're talking about now. And so now that people are aware of that, again, the data is there. It's elected officials have to be the ones to change
that. It definitely stressed the middle class. But if we had in place programs that were aggressively retraining people, that were aggressively—
That was supposedly the case. Well, when they decided to do those things, they were supposedly retraining.
Well, no, the businesses didn't aggressively retrain people. They laid them off, okay? And there was not in place governmental aggressive retraining because the government failed to recognize and has failed to support a rapidly evolving marketplace, okay? Because it's not just moving abroad that costs jobs, it's also technological innovation.
Right.
So everyone in the ground line telephone company lost their jobs, right? Because there's really no...
Right.
So we've only got wireless phones now primarily. And similarly with other kinds of businesses, the people who made CD-ROMs, they're not making CD-ROMs anymore. Other countries have aggressive retraining programs to basically support the technologically driven economies that will involve periodic dislocations of jobs because of technological breakthroughs. And if those kinds of breakthroughs are supported with retraining, the economy is actually going to be more vibrant because the workers will be there to do the new jobs. And there won't be the dislocation and problems associated with losing the old job. Half of the problem we have in America with respect to moving towards a greener economy is the argument that it's going to cost a lot of jobs when we shift technologically from what we have to something greener. Well, you know, we ought to be aggressively retraining and tooling up for the future rather than digging in our heels and trying to stick with the past.
Let's go to Mike from Kenosha. Good morning to you, Mike. Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
It's cold out. That's what I say.
Yeah, well.
But hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm sorry. I just got out of the parking lot.
It's January. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes,
sir. I couldn't agree more with the thesis of your conversation this morning. One thing that I find as somebody from Wisconsin is the lack of conversation in regards to the Wisconsin idea. Have you guys talked about that much?
The Wisconsin idea, meaning the open walls, the notion that what are you describing as the Wisconsin idea?
The idea is fighting Bob Follett's vision of the university system being somewhat of an incubator, a forecaster, of the trends of the future, and to use our students in our university system as a way forward to navigate, you know, win-win policy and for everybody, for commerce as well as the individual. The Wisconsin idea was even brought up by Tommy Thompson in the last election cycle when he was running around the state talking about it. And I think from a Wisconsinite's perspective, first of all, talking about and putting some life back into the Wisconsin idea, which I think makes a lot of sense. You know, for young people to be engaged in identifying where the future is going to lie, and at that time you can manage the destruction of the current market as well as prepare a path forward to create win-wins, you know, for the new market. So it's a progressive thing. Again, it originated, as I recall, from Bob La Follette back in the day. And here in Wisconsin, which I believe is the core, the center of our democracy, of our republic here in America.
Hey, Mike, thank you very much for the call. Sandy, I'll let you respond on the other side. 844-967-2789. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Tuesday. I mean, Tuesdays with my co-host Sandy Williams. And Sandy, your thoughts on the last caller?
Well, the Wisconsin idea, you know, Wisconsin has long been a leader in progressive thinking. And by progressive, I'm not talking about the political progressivism. I'm just thinking about future thought, okay? And lots of that was based on the fact that Wisconsin has always sort of invested more in its university system than other states. And the University of Wisconsin has long been one of the leading public universities in the country. It continues to be, but unfortunately, every year it sort of declines in its rating as compared to other public universities because, unfortunately, our legislature has decided to invest less money in the university system and to feature the university system less. But Wisconsin was long a leader in legislation, laws, in establishing the civil service system, in establishing the regulation of utilities and railroads, in regulating the commerce in the state, in all sorts of ways, in setting up Alumni Foundation to do research on behalf of the university to develop an endowment. Wisconsin is capable of a great deal of forward-looking thought, and I hope that we continue to do that and that maybe the state could get back to being a leader in terms of solving problems.
Well, if I'm listening to and if the determination of solving those problems is up to Robin Voss, I don't think we're ever going to be able to overcome that. Let's go to Jack from Merrimack. Hey, good morning to you, Jack. You say what, sir?
Good morning. I say that regarding the education system, this has been a consistent Republican plan to decimate the education system all over, not just in Wisconsin, but all over the country for decades, at least since the 1970s when I first read about it. That isn't really quite what I wanted to address this morning.
Go ahead.
But Okay, I'll make this as quick as possible. Last night there was an interview with a billionaire on Maggie Dawn's show. And this is a guy who was supposed to be one of the job creators. He got part of this multi-trillion dollar tax welfare gift just a few years ago. It was pretty clear during the interview, though, that he wasn't interested in job creation. He was lamenting the fact he hadn't made even more money. Now, one question I often ask my conservative friends is, how much is enough? And I've never received a real answer to that question. Since this job creators myth, this was started by Reaganomics, the so-called trickle-down economics, which has never worked, in the 1980s. The middle class has decreased from nearly two-thirds of us to down to around half, and the richest have had their incomes increased by trillions. Big corporations who also got this welfare tax break, they spent that break on stock buybacks, which increases stock value, which is mostly owned by, guess what, the rich ones at the top. They continue to price gouge Americans also. According to Business Insider, the Wall Street Journal, roughly two-thirds of the so-called inflation is actually corporate price gouging, giving the richest companies, guess what, even greater profits. What a surprise. And they're allowed to declare, for instance, real employees private contractors, so they don't even have to worry about little things like benefits or a 40-hour work week, overtime. It's no wonder many Americans feel job insecurity. They're afraid to even get health care. They feel their taxes are unfair. Now, here's the problem. It's Republicans who pretty much started all this, and they've used this economic fear to blame Democrats, when they've refused to increase minimum wages to a living wage, refused to give, keep giving trillions to the richest and rich corporations, and passed union-busting legislation. And I think at least one part of the solution is to first elect those who will vote for their constituents' interests instead of big money owners, donors. And in order to do that, we've got to educate the majority of voters on what the real problem is, which is the greed of the rich and rich corporations.
Hey, Jack, thank you very much for the call. Sandy, you said a mouthful.
Well, he did. And there's no question that business models have gotten warped, and a big part of that has been not recognizing the value of human capital and finding ways around minimizing the costs associated with human capital to the point where we end up with this shrinking middle class. Not only do we have a shrinking middle class, but I guarantee you that if we did an analysis of the budget of the middle class that remains, we'd find that that budget is now more stressed because of the requirement that they pay for benefits out of their posts, salary after they receive it, rather than coming out of the employer before they receive it. And so, yes, we need to make sure that we get the people to focus in politics on voting for politicians who are going to address the real problems faced by Tom, Dick, and Mary in the society. And whether those are Republicans or Democrats, people need to wake up the politicians that they are potentially going to vote for and make sure that they address this problem in America of the architecture of our economy, because our economy is definitely trending in the direction of not working for vast portions of the country.
You know, Sandy, you talk about those things, and as long as they can steer people into the Hunter Biden and the Biden crime family and all those kinds of things, then people can't think about the things that really are impacting and affecting them.
Well, and social problems.
Right.
Whether we're going to worry about transsexualism and all the things that matter and are significant
right.
to the people for whom they're significant, but they are not addressing the serious sociological situations faced by a vast number of people in this country who reside below the top 10% of Americans. You know, you can drive around American cities and drive through the suburbs and think that America is doing great, and you have to realize that those suburbs only represent a fraction of America, and they represent the fraction that's doing well, and everyone else is not.
All right. Thank everybody who made the show go. Thank you, Sandy, as always. Thank you, Calvin. Up next, Jane Mattner and Greg Bach and
Mattner on air.
Mattner on air. All right. See you later. You really got me now. You got me so.